I itself is not a liberator. It creates means, not goals.
The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture.
So hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Labors in SOAR. In this podcast, we look over the shoulders of the giants of science and present captivating stories about the machinery surrounding the scientific world. So welcome again. My name is Marta.
And my name is Christoph.
And I'm Bernd.
So after all the science communication chats that we had during this season, we're very happy to have with us Fernando Racimo. Fernando is an associate professor on evolutionary genomics at the University of Copenhagen and has participated in many important studies on understanding ancient human DNA. Most importantly, however, Fernando, besides being a research leader, is also a member and activist of Scientist Rebellion. That is a group that brings scientists and academics together to fight for climate justice. Scientist Rebellion believes that the science community as a group has a moral duty to embrace activism and demand not only attention to the climate change, but also a systemic change in our society to face this breakdown. So welcome again, Fernando. Again, we're very happy to have you here.
Thank you. And thank you so much for the invitation. That was a better introduction than I could have done myself.
Yeah, Fernando, also welcome from my side. As Marta already told us, your lab focuses on evolutionary processes, and in particular human evolution and ancient selection. And just curiosity for our listeners, you were also one of the authors of the Nobel Prize winning work of Svante Paabo.
That was quite a while ago. That was when I was in my science infancy. So that was after my bachelor's. I spent some time in Leipzig, where Svante Paabo has a research group. And then during my PhD, I did some collaboration work together with that group. So yeah, it was a bit of a long time ago, but it was a lot of fun to work there.
So, but putting this together with our big topic of this episode, climate change, do you think we will follow the Neanderthal to the club of extinct species very soon, or is there still hope?
Well, so I mean, I like to say that like hope is something we make. So I think it's an open book whether what will happen to us as a species. But as you say, I mean the situation is really bad. And in the current course that we're in, we're heading for much worse. So I'm not sure if extinction of the human species is in the horizon, but definitely sort of the end of our current societies as we know them, if we stay with business as usual.
Maybe we can go into a bit more detail here, if you don't mind. So yeah. Talking numbers, for example, the Paris Agreement of 2015, it agreed on to limit the increase in the mean global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But now what we're facing, actually, it's much worse, with an estimated increase between 2 and 4 degrees. Just taking these numbers, can you give us a little bit of contextualization, what it actually means?
Yeah, what it actually means is a whole lot of death happening now and on our way. It's a lot of scientists are now admitting that the limit of 1.5 is probably lost, and probably also the 2 degree target. And so what's coming is bad. The question is like how bad we want this to be, and how much we can allow this to be. Like there's really bad scenarios, and it's also really hard to think about how we can think how society could sort of persist at a scenario of 2 or 3 degrees. I mean, most of human history, I mean, all of like the Neolithic revolution, the growth of human societies over the last few thousand years it has happened within a very narrow band of temperatures, well below what we're facing in just a few decades. And so to me, at least, it's very hard to think about how we'll be able to grow food, how we'll be able to feed people as we face things like massive crop collapse. I mean, some studies predict up to 50% crop collapses in the near future. And on top of that, things like heat waves, rises in sea levels, destroying cities. It's really scary. And yeah, it's also very uncertain, right? It's like we're facing a future that we know is bad, but we don't really know how bad it is because it's hard to predict.
Yeah, I believe it's hard to predict. So just for me as a kind of novice to this topic also, is it like we kind of can estimate the consequences, but now it's more a question of time looking at what is happening?
Yeah, I mean, I would also say it's a question of action, right? So like, I mean, we can keep on making predictions. There's been IPCC reports made over the last few decades. Every IPCC report is worse, and every IPCC report says that we have ever less time to avoid the worst scenarios. But at the end of the day, we have to face the situation that it like action needs to happen, right? So like another report will probably come out and tell us that things are even worse than the last one. The question is like, is that the role of scientists here to keep making ever worse predictions for what's ahead, or if there's something else that we can do as a scientific community?
Talking about the IPCC report, Scientist Rebellion actually shared some parts to prevent watering down of the report at the end. Can we even trust the IPCC report, or did you find any big changes at the end when it was fully released?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So yeah, so the thing about the IPCC report is that it's a joint product of the scientific community and policymakers and politicians. So there's a point at which the scientists, you know, give the report to politicians from all the world, and they can run rampart with edits. And that's why Scientists Rebellion, I believe this was in 2021, released the pre-edited version of the report. And some months later, the edited version, the official version of the report was released. And this was in some sense an act of civil disobedience, because scientists agree not to release the report until it's actually officially published, but they were sort of like defying the politics there. And yes, of course, there were several things that were removed, things like emphasis on phasing out coal, emphasis on transforming, like radical transformation of our food systems, and things were added as well by several countries. There was added emphasis on technologies as solutions, sort of like technological solutionism is something that is very prevalent in politics today. Like, you know, we just need to develop new methods, new technologies that will get us out of the crisis. Things like carbon capture and storage, which are, you know, very unrealistic, and like without actually phasing out fossil fuels, we'll not actually be able to do much. So yeah, there were definitely edits that happened throughout the document, which reflects sort of the current dynamics today between science and policymakers. That politicians, even though they say they're listening to the science, they're not really acting up on the science as they should.
Oh yeah, that's pretty interesting. But given that your organization seems to have connections up to the highest transnational organizations, could you give us an overview what Scientist Rebellion actually is?
Yes, we're everywhere. We're in the shadows everywhere. No, Scientist Rebellion is essentially a group of scientists and academics and scholars. Of all sort of academic levels, anywhere from students of science all the way to PhD students, postdocs, lecturers, full professors, and just people that feel connected somehow to the science or feel like they know enough to, about the science that they want to contribute to the movement. And sort of what unites us is that we understand that continuing to do the same thing that we've done so far as scientists, as academics, meaning publishing papers, publishing reports, talking politely to politicians, you know, asking them to do what they should be doing, has not worked. It's It's been 30 years of IPCC reports and of COP meetings, and none of that has worked. I mean, CO2 concentrations are higher than they've ever been, and they're rising faster than ever. And so it's scientists have realized that these conventional modes of action have not worked, and we are changing tactics. We're trying to learn a bit from history, learning from other instances in the past where major social transformations happened. And what's common through a lot of these episodes is the presence of civil disobedience or direct action, meaning breaking some sort of rule or law to call attention to the fact that society is not working the way it should. Something is happening that is highly unjust. And so we're calling attention to the problem. In this case, it's the climate and ecological emergency and the lack of action with respect to it.
So do you also have some concrete demands for policymakers or for society?
Yeah, so this is also the dynamics. We're a very big group. So there's a bit of a dynamics between sort of like the global group and the local groups. I think we're operating in over 32 countries. And there's a lot of things that are unjust today across the world. And so scientist rebellion groups locally try to work with other climate or ecological or social movements and help in their struggles. So there's always local demands. And there's sort of like general global demands, which are more like broadly like act on the science, you know, phase out fossil fuels as fast as possible. Transform our society so that they don't depend on ever larger amounts of growth, but that are centered around well-being. But in each country, there's very concrete demands that have to do with the particular governments and industries that are operating in that country. So and it also depends a lot on campaigns that happen over the years. So currently, for example, in Denmark, we're running a campaign because the Danish government is planning to expand the airport here. So there's a campaign here to stop airport expansion, to ban private jets, to address sort of some of the more ecological and economic injustices linked to the climate crisis. But in other countries, you'll find other types of demands. For example, the Global South, many scientist rebellion groups have demands related to extractivism, to extracting ever larger amounts of resources from the earth and from native communities. So it really varies a lot depending on the country, but a lot of these demands sort of articulate together with each other. And that's also why international cooperation between local groups is important.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Also because I'm in Lisbon currently and they're also planning to expand the airport here. So I was just
there is a scientist rebellion group in Portugal for sure. There's some very active people there.
Yeah. But so the main strategy that you also mentioned, I guess, to achieve these targets is civil disobedience. So maybe could you tell us a bit more what civil disobedience is?
Yeah, so civil disobedience involves consciously breaking a law or a rule, something that is established in society as doing something that is established as being illegal in an effort to draw attention to some problematic in society, some injustice that is being committed more broadly. And that could involve anything from blocking a road so that cars cannot pass. It can involve things like occupying a building, occupying a government building, or a corporate headquarters. It can also involve throwing paint at a building. One action that is very frequent in Scientist Rebellion also is was the first action that Scientist Rebellion did in London is pasting scientific papers on the walls of an institution. So actually the first action by Scientist Rebellion were two scientists that went to the Royal Society and pasted some scientific papers calling out the society for not being vocal, not actually calling out the emergency, the climate emergency that the world living through. They got arrested, and it was sort of the spark that led to a lot of other actions across the world. So the sort of pasting papers is a common action, but there's other actions that we do across the range of things that maybe are maybe breaking a norm, maybe not a rule, sort of doing things that are unconventional, maybe interrupting, for example, a research talk to talk about the climate and ecological emergency, all the way to heavier things like in Spain, for example, several scientists threw paint at the parliament in Madrid in a big action a few years ago, now are facing heavy charges for that. So it's basically breaking a law, and the idea is that we're trying to draw attention, but also trying to draw some sympathy. We're trying to say, you know, we're going to put some meat in the game. We're not just going to talk about the climate crisis over and over. We are worried enough, we're scared enough that we're doing this. So we'd rather not be doing it, mm-hmm. but the sort of policymakers, politicians have pushed us to do this. And it's also a way to encourage others, not just scientists, but broadly society, to also rise up and basically call out power for perpetuating these injustices.
Yeah, but so your message, this is a very naive question, but your message, it's not climate change exists, but rather we need to do something and we need to act, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, this varies a lot in my country and the sort of by levels of climate literacy. So now it also has evolved over time. You know, like in the early days of Scientist Rebellion, we would just demand listen to the science, you know, like do what scientists are recommending. But now we're sort of trying to also pursue more concrete things because we've realized that it's also easier to convey very concrete messages, like things like banning private jets or stop highway expansions. In Germany, for example, I was involved in several actions where we were calling for a speed limit in German highways and an end to car lobbyism and sort of political funds going from the car industry into politics. So the message goes beyond just like there is a problem, but also current power structures are failing to address this and are often complicit in the problem as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. But so when you're doing these acts, you're trying to get the attention of the public, the policymakers, both at the same time, or each act has a different target, let's say?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the action. I would say our primary target is the public. And so often we will do actions where we're confronting policymakers, confronting politicians, but we're doing it to talk to the public and say, look, these people are not listening to us, even though they might say that they're always listening to the science. You know, we wouldn't be here occupying this ministry if papers and nice conversation was enough. So we're clearly not being listened to. So I would say that the primary audience is the public, but often we also want to address policymakers and politicians or particular actors. But yeah, I'd say that it's more like talking about power to the public rather than talking to power. And that has also sort of been an increased emphasis in the last few years.
Yeah, but can I continue on that? Just because I have the feeling that there might also be a disadvantage when you say, okay, you try to reach the public, but I have the feeling that many of these actions also tend to polarize people quite a lot. So those who support you already, they might support you more, but you also create stronger opponents.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's something an issue that is raised often. And I have several answers to that. One of them is, so some people might say, you know, like you might get people angry just from the fact that you're interrupting their day, for example, like people driving a car or a truck and you're blocking the road. They might be angry at that, or if you're throwing paint at a building, maybe they're like the people working in that building. And in that respect, I would say, yes, there's always anger. There's always some form of disruption. I mean, the action wouldn't be, if it wasn't disruptive, it wouldn't call attention. Actually, we usually get the media to pay attention to this and to amplify the message when the action is disruptive. And we try to explain to the people whose days are being disturbed, like, look, we'd rather not be doing this. We'd rather be at our homes, enjoying time with our families. But we've been pushed to this. And sometimes people end up sort of like understanding why this is happening. Not always, but they end up understanding what this is happening. But that's, I would say, the people sort of being disturbed are not necessarily the primary target. It's the people watching the action from social media or from the media, right? And then there's the other point that, like, even there's been several social science studies about this, that even though some of these actions might be disruptive, might cause negative feelings or a particular group of people, they still get the people to talk about the problem. And I would say the primary example of that is the actions by Just Stop Oil or by Last Generation doing paint throwing at soup throwing at paintings. even though, you know, you might get some negative feelings like the activists, you get the media to talk about this. I was recently at a panel where one of the authors, a climate expert, she was talking about these actions in the US, and she got contacted by journalists who were telling her, do you think these actions are polarizing, right? Like, this can't be helping. But then she's like, yeah, but you contacted me from the media, and now I'm talking to you in this TV channel, which is something that rarely happens in other contexts. So that's one aspect. And then I would say the final aspect is that in many respects, I think, I wouldn't say it's polarization, but more like the evincing of a bridge that I don't think exists is important. So even though, so it's sort of showing that the connection between government, science, and the public is a lot more tenuous or a lot more broken than it really is. I think it's important. It's important that we talk to the public and say, like, look, it's not all like roses and candy. We're not all trying to help together and bring about the green transition. There's many actors here that are trying to prevent this. And so maybe you could call this a certain form of polarization, but I think it's a polarization that's perhaps needed to bring people that are maybe supported but not acting to act.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. Sorry to play the advocatus diaboli here in this matter, because you said before that actually right now climate literacy is not needed anymore. Don't you think, like?
No, I would say it's just it differs by country. I'm thinking. I was talking to an activist, Gianluca Grimalda, who's a very famous activist because he got fired for refusing to fly as part of his research project. He's also a member of Scientist Rebellion. And he was telling me that in Papua New Guinea, for example, climate literacy levels are very low. And so people don't understand that the link between the, you know, rising temperatures is companies in the global north are spewing out huge amounts of fossil fuels into the atmosphere. So in some sense, they see the climate changing, but they have they don't have the information needed to sort of tackle it in the right way. But in other countries, of course, climate literacy is much higher. The question is sort of, it's not just literacy about the science, but also literacy about how you create change, how you transform society. And in that sense, even in, I would say, in countries in Europe and in global north, there's very low literacy about how sociological, societal change has happened in the past, partly on purpose. So we may know a lot about the science of climate change, the ecological breakdown, but very few people know that a lot of the civil rights movement, the decolonization movements, the women's rights movements, a large part of that was through disruption, through mass mobilizations, through general strikes. That's not something that is widely taught at the university level or anywhere at any point in education.
So I mean, like the Malcolm X and Martin Luther King in the Black empowerment movement.
Yeah, among other movements, there's also sort of a bit of a sanitation of what those movements were. Like, you know, like the sort of the people think that, you know, people made nice speeches and then everybody realized, oh, you know, we should actually give civil rights to people of color, and then we just voted for the right people to do that. But a lot of that involved street blockades, much heavier disruption than what's actually happening with the climate movement right now. In the women's voting movement, a lot of that involved destruction of property, putting, you know, bombs on mailboxes, and it was disruptive and it was destructive of property, but it got the women to vote. So it's I think it's maybe resurfacing a lot of this history of social transformation, the lack of literacy in that respect.
Yeah, and I totally get what you mean. I also experienced it that when there was something from Scientist Rebellion or from the Last Generation, the news, that you got to engage with people, and there were talks about climate change. But nevertheless, I read that two major activist groups like the Last Generation or Extinction Rebellion, they started like the next phase of the protest. So they try to increase the participation now and try to cooperate with other organizations on disobedient gatherings. Could we see Scientist Rebellion follow this strategy in the future somehow?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been involved often with Extinction. I mean, we've done actions together with Extinction Rebellion, with Last Generation, often in sort of large gatherings of people occupying intersections here in Denmark, but also in the UK, in Germany. I think Extinction Rebellion is pursuing that, but there's other groups, like I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Last Generation or Just the Poil that was choosing more strategies like climate defiance type strategies, like in the US, where it's a few people that go into a room where a politician is talking or a fossil fuel executive is talking, and they just disrupt the whole meeting. And that gets a lot of attention with just very few resources. So you don't need to get, you know, 40,000 people into an intersection. You just need 4 or 5 people with a banner. And so different groups are exploring different strategies. And I think that's healthy. That's what should happen. I think we need a lot of different strategies. And I think in general, Scientist Rebellion has been quite adaptable. We're just there to support what's happening and to say, you know, we are doing this as well. So this is why we've often been involved in things like XR type protests, but also more disruptive things like Just the Poil or Last Generation type protests. It's basically we try not to so much set up an agenda here, because there's people with a lot more experience than us doing activism in the street and putting a lot more meat in the game. And so we try to listen to what activist groups are doing and see where we can help. And so showing that scientists are there as well. In Sweden, just last week, the group by Greta Thunberg, who's now doing more disruptive things than she was doing with Fridays for Future. Now they're blocking the road in front of the Swedish parliament. There were several people from Scientist Rebellion that were sitting together with her with lab coats showing, you know, it's not just young people, the scientists are there. We're also worried. And what Greta is doing is absolutely what should be happening.
Following up a little bit more on the strategy, because you also mentioned that there were more radical approaches, for example, by the civil rights movement in the US. What would you answer to people? I guess there are people who demand more, even more radical actions than just blocking roads. What would you answer them? And could you see Scientist Rebellion changing their strategy?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things to be aware of is sort of what we mean by radical. Sort of radical can mean being more disruptive. Under some definitions, I mean, radical means, you know, going to the root of the problem. It could mean things like sabotage of oil pipelines. It could mean sabotage of planes while in the ground. But I mean, under some definitions, you might also say, well, more radical means more violent, right? And it's a tactical decision whether you think that with more violence you can convince more people. I'm not sure. I'm sort of, I guess, agnostic a little bit about that. And there's another dimension here, which is, you know, what people are willing to do for very mild things. Here in Europe, you can get charged with criminal charges. Here in Denmark, just for putting up scientific papers and walls, you can get criminal charges. You can get to go to prison for doing what a civil rights sort of context would not be super radical, which is like lowering yourself to a car, like several scientists did in Germany. These scientists got several days in prison. And so,
but sorry to interrupt you here, yeah. But why did people get in prison for posting scientific papers?
So it was in Germany, it was several scientists that went to prison for occupying, I think it was the BMW pavilion in Munich. Mm-hmm. I think they went to prison for a week. They're still going through the trials now. This is one of the things that I'm seeing a lot in sort of Scientist Rebellion social media. Several scientists are talking to the judge in the last few weeks. But again, under a civil rights context or a women's voting movement context, that would be super radical. Would make sense, more sense to pursue other strategies like sabotage, for example. It's worked in the past, maybe. The question is sort of like, I guess one question is what the movement can do and also what you can convince people to do. I don't think personally I would be ready to face like several months of prison, but I would be supportive of people that would like to pursue that. And I would try to find a way to support them, as a lot of scientists are doing right now. Yeah, and then the question of violence, again, this is coming from the social sciences. There is some social science literature that argues that, that nonviolence is more convincing than violence. That being said, there's also debates about what constitutes violence, you know, where violence to property is should be considered violence. And I think these are also internal debates that are being had, not just within Scientist Rebellion, but within other civil disobedience movements. Like, what are the best tactics to pursue? I don't have a straightforward answer. Sorry.
I guess there is no perfect answer to this question. Otherwise, the groups would already follow it.
Yeah.
But maybe just to complement this thought, on the contrary, could we also go towards a more solution-oriented conversation instead of more protest, less protest, and I don't know, but for example, trying to set up more not destructive but constructive projects, even though this might sound hard.
Yeah, so I think yes to the second part of your question, but maybe not so much the first part of the question. So this sort of conversations or solution-based approaches, I mean, this is what the scientific community has tried for over 30 years now. Again, trying to talk politicians, trying to be nice, to like, you know, find ways to get into policymaking situations. And I'm thinking things like the COP process, for example, where scientists are trying to talk directly to politicians. And you know, honestly, the COP process to me is at this point a complete, it's not just a failure, it's almost like a mockery of scientific discussion. It's the last one was run by an oil baron in the United Arab Emirates, and the next one will be run by a country whose main economic output is oil. And now there's even more oil lobbies in the COP than several national delegations. So I think trying to pursue conversations without evincing structures of power, I don't think that would lead to much, because it sort of assumes that everybody's on the same position, which is not the case. There's people with a lot more power making the decisions, neither the public nor scientists are being listened to. So the second part of your question, so sort of constructive things, I do agree with that. I think disruption can also be constructive. We can sort of show to the world what an alternative world could look like. And there's been several protests that have aimed or tried to do this. And I'm thinking one of the first actions we had in Scientist Rebellion Denmark was actually we blocked the street in front of the climate ministry here while turning it into a classroom. So we had lecturers, 10, 11 lecturers that were given classroom lectures for 10, 15 minutes each in front of we set up chairs on the street while we blocked it. And I think it was beyond the disruption that it caused, I think it was one of the most beautiful actions I've been involved in. But it also showed me that, you know, why are we not teaching in the middle of the street? Why is the street so dominated by cars? Why have we allowed urban planners to turn our streets into car-centric places rather than learning-centered places? And we're often talking to NGOs and other groups that are proposing the right things like degrowing economies in the global north, stopping extraction in the global south, protecting areas. But I think the solutions are there, and they've been there for a long time. And I fear that sometimes sort of solution-oriented talks can hide the underlying injustices that are being committed. I don't think like Native American communities being displaced by extractivism, by companies in the global north, I don't think they necessarily would talk about solutions. They would, like, their entire homes are being destroyed just to make a new mine or to fuel our economy. So I think it's acknowledging that it's more than just solutions. It's injustices, and it's sort of addressing power structures that maybe have been sort of kept hidden before, and the disruption sort of brings them out to the light.
Do you think that we as a society are ready for the necessities?
Yeah, but I think it's I think a lot of climate policies will make life easier, right? So like one of the easiest thing that we could do is reducing the working week. There's things like reducing the working week to 4 or 3 days. A lot of the problem right now is that we're producing too much, right? And we have economies that are dependent on producing ever larger quantities of output. We're using up the earth. I think Denmark uses something like 3.5 earths. So if everybody consumed the way Denmark consumes, we wouldn't be able to live in this planet. A lot of things, you know, things like a universal basic income, so that people don't feel afraid to participate in politics or to rise up their voice. Reducing energy input into Europe and North America, so we don't need to rely on extracting more oil from places like Ecuador, from places like the Middle East. Also, that would probably also stop the incentives for war in places like the Middle East, because a lot of the reason why we have conflicts in places outside of the global north is because we need to secure ever larger quantities of energy and materials to feed this sort of like giant golem of capital growth. I think it's about talking to, I mean, I think a lot of social movements have interests aligned to the climate movement. And it's learning that a lot of climate policies will just make our lives better. It might mean that, you know, we don't get to fly across the world to Thailand every year, but it might make our lives a lot easier, because we'll have more time to spend with our families and our friends, and less time grinding away in our jobs.
But so I guess, since we're actually four scientists discussing about climate change and climate activism, how did you choose to get involved?
This was in 2020 when we first started having conversations about Scientist Rebellion in Denmark. So it was me and another person who was in Extinction Rebellion at the time. So I had done some actions with Extinction Rebellion. I had never broken the law, but I had done some support work for Extinction Rebellion, like doing social media work or doing outreach for XR. But I increasingly realized, you know, like in all these protests, there's people from many different jobs. There's teachers, there's doctors, there's students. There's people that don't even have a job, but they're risking arrest. But the scientists were not there. And I think that, to me, was a bit of a disconnect, because we were the ones telling people, you know, you have to protest. Things are not the way they should be. But scientists were nowhere to be seen, at least around 2020. And I think a lot of scientists across the world were feeling that. And so you started seeing parallel groups of scientists emerging in places like Germany, the UK, Italy, Spain. We convinced other people within our communities, you know, we should also be supporting these movements. We shouldn't just be sitting on the sidelines, letting others be arrested. We started doing small actions. Eventually we realized other groups existed, so we started connecting with each other and supporting each other. Eventually, we reached a critical mass that we could do pretty disruptive things within our countries. We're still growing in many places and appearing in new countries, but it was hard at the beginning. I would say it still is difficult in some sense to talk to other scientists who are not activists. But I find increasingly more support or more approval of what we're doing within the more, you know, traditional academic communities. It was a matter of finding other people, other scientists that had similar feelings and trying to do things together.
Yeah, but about that, do you think we need to change how people are taught, let's say, and with how they think a scientist should be and how she should act? Because if I think of my example, I don't think the knowledge that they teach me during my master or my bachelor was to how to be an activist, but was rather how to be a good scientist and not discuss.
Absolutely. Yes. So I think our own academic institutions need to change. The massive transformation that we need includes the university and academia as well. I look forward to a day where universities are not places where you're taught to that a good citizen is a citizen that doesn't protest, for example. I mean, to me, a good citizen is a person that protests regularly because there's a lot of injustices happening in society. It shouldn't just be a person that goes to vote every 4 years and stays passive the rest of the time. So, to me, a good scientist is a scientist that does activism. And it's a matter of radically changing our curricula, radically changing what we teach our students, how we teach our students, and also trying to efface a lot of the hierarchies that exist within the university today, where sort of somehow students are seen as people that need to be credentialed into being proper citizens. I feel like I've learned a lot from people that are not faculty, that are perhaps students, haven't gotten a PhD, and they've taught me so much more than what a lot of faculty here have taught me. So it's a question of radically changing our curricula, changing what the university is and what it is for. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we talked about civil disobedience and resistance, but there is a very strong way of communicating and engaging people. But what if someone is shy, for example? Which other ways could they get involved?
Yeah, so that's a good point. And I don't think it's just shyness. I mean, a lot of people have vulnerabilities that may prevent them from engaging in civil disobedience. Maybe you don't have a passport, or you're in a foreign country where you might risk being thrown out of the country. Mm. You might be a person of color, and you know a lot of police discriminates against people of color, against indigenous people. They're treated much, much worse than white males doing this. So gender is also a big dimension here. And in Scientist Rebellion, as in many other groups, we constantly think about this. And you're not supposed to do anything where you don't feel that you yourself don't want to do, right? So there's a lot of roles beyond breaking the law for an action to actually happen. We have this, when we talk about this, we show this sort of picture of an iceberg, where like at the top of the iceberg, you see the scientists, the activists that are breaking the law, which is what you see in media and social media. But below that, there's a whole community of people that are contributing to the action and making it actually happen. And that includes taking photographs, ensuring that the activists are doing well, that their well-being is taken care of, writing press releases, doing outreach for the action, preparing food, making sure that the police is acting the way they should. So welcoming activists when they come out of a police station, for example, so that they feel that they're being taken care of. There's a whole set of actions, and in Scientist Rebellion that is very true. I mean, there's a lot of scientists, a lot of academics that are contributing from without a position of high visibility, I would say. And it's super important, and that work is just as important as the work of people who are just sitting on a road waiting to be arrested.
Yeah, because I do believe that, like you said, the way we are taught, we don't even think about how we can get involved. The only thing we see is what we see, like on social media, news, and we see scientists gluing things or gluing themselves to cars and so on, but we don't even think that there's a whole machine behind it that is actually operating.
Yep. So, yeah, absolutely. I think maybe that's a failure of us. We should definitely advertise that there's many other many other roles beyond arrest. It's also, in some sense, it's also a way for people to learn what it is to do an action. So you can dip your toes into an action by taking a non-risky role. And that's sort of how I ended up doing more risky things. I started in XR doing support work. And at some point I realized I was ready to break the law, and I transitioned to that. But there's often actions where I'm not breaking the law. I'm just helping out, maybe taking a video of an activist, interviewing an activist while they're breaking the law. So there's a whole range of things that can be done outside of the highly visible things.
Thank you for this interesting insights into Scientist Rebellion. As we are rapidly approaching now the end of our interview, this reminds me of one of our last interview when we talked with Anne Glover, the former chief scientific advisor of the European Parliament. And she had a pretty pessimistic outlook on the future of climate change policy. I feel a little bit like in the movie Don't Look Up asking this question, but are there any projects, people or statistics, something that give you hope?
Yeah, I would say activists give me hope, and the more activists I see, the more hope I get. I think, you know, the world that we want to create will be created by more and more people rising up. And so I think I'm not sure. I'm not a pessimist. Maybe some days I'm more of a pessimist. Some days I'm more of an optimist. But I can tell you that when I'm in an action, when I see other people being just as engaged or more engaged than I am, I feel like there's a whole world waiting to be born of people thinking and actively living in a very different type of economy and community than what is normalized today. So yeah, I would say activism gives me hope. And the more people are out there breaking the law, blocking streets, occupying buildings, the more hopeful I will be.
Great answer. And with this, I would like to wrap it up. I think what everybody should have learned by now is what scientists learned some years ago, that just advising policymakers doesn't work. And now it's time to act. So this is why they decided to found Scientists Rebellion, which is a globally organized activist group that uses civil disobedience as a tool to draw attention to, I would say, the most pressing issue of our times, climate change. So we heard that we actually can use a lot of different strategy, not only civil disobedience, to draw attention to this matter. But in the end, we really need better policies, and we really need to change something. And everybody can get involved and should get involved. There is not only those acts of gluing yourself to the street, you can also just support the activists. But I think it's time to get active. I hope I summarized it quite well, but I think part of our podcast, also one of the reasons why we invited you, is not only to learn about Scientist Rebellion and how you can actually apply science communication in the real world, but maybe also to talk a little bit about climate change and to give you a stage. So we know we're not the biggest podcast, but if you have anything
yet.
To add, any
yet.
Message yet, yeah. But Fernando, if you have anything to add or a message you want to deliver to our listeners, please go ahead.
Wherever you are, you have a lot more power than you think you have, and just contact your local civil resistance group, whether that be Scientist Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, Extinction Rebellion, Last Generation. There's many other groups out there, Climate Defiance. Just go to an intermeeting, to one of these groups, and you'll realize you have a lot more power than you think you have. And there's a lot you can do even as an individual once you join one of these groups.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And apart from these groups, how can people reach you or get notifications from Scientist Rebellion?
So you can visit scientistrebellion.org. We have a website. We have intermeetings every week. I think it's every Monday. You can look at the intermeetings on the website. And we also have various local chapters. In the website, you can look at the email for each of the local chapters. So just send an email to whichever country you're in, and somebody will contact you. I would highly recommend attending one of these intro meetings because they talk about, you know, how we organize, how we communicate within the movement, and what are the different roles that you can take. And they're all over Zoom, so wherever you are, you can attend it.
Yeah. So I'm very happy with the interview. Thanks for coming. You can reach us on our website, laborinsoa.de, or on various social media platforms. And with that, I think that's the end of this last episode of this season about science communication. And I hope we see you in our next season. Thank you, Fernando.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to talk with you.
No, it was great. It was great.